What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode 2 of Caribbean Discs here on Carnival Radio London. Carnival Radio. London. Today, I'm sitting down with Calypsonian, musician, singer-songwriter, social commentator, storyteller and experimentalist, Alexander de Great. So welcome, Alex.
Thank you.
Why don't we start with you telling us how you got where you are today?
Wow, that'll take 50 years. No, it's actually been 50 years odd. I was born in Trinidad. First music I heard would have been calypso. I left there between the age of about 3.5 and 4, came here with my parents in the early 1950s, as lots of Caribbeans did. And I wasn't particularly enamored of music one way or the other. I liked music, but generally, whatever was around, you know, folk songs, anything that I could hear. But the first song that really impinged on me and made had an effect was Sparrow's Carnival Boycott. Carnival Boycott was a song about him boycotting Carnival because of, and I didn't understand what that was about. All I knew was there was a line in the chorus that said, "And let the Queen run the show without steel band and calypso. Man, if you want to go, you could go down there, but me ain't going nowhere." And I thought the Queen was Queen Elizabeth II. He actually meant the Carnival Queen, but I didn't know that. And in the 50s, it was considered incredibly cheeky to sing something like that about the Queen. I was about 8. Later on, I realized that it was about the Carnival Queen. I realized that the boycott was because the Calypso monarch at the time received $25. That was the price. Okay. Trinidad dollars, not US dollars.
Okay.
But the Carnival Queen got $5,000 and a car. So there was a complete imbalance in between the culture and the beauty contest, and that's what he was complaining about. And of course, since then, it's got much better. But I was very impressed with that. And then I suppose the thing that really got me interested, let me say this. My father used to sing folk songs. My mother was a fantastic singer, both a great sort of soprano for regular classical stuff, but she could also sing very low, and she sang Ella Fitzgerald stuff. So that was all around as well. There was a mix of music, and my dad liked blues, and he introduced me to things like Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee and Sister Rosetta Tharpe, who was the most amazing guitar player back in, you know, the 40s and 50s. So I listened to stuff without particularly desiring to be a musician. And then at about the age of 12 or 13, the Beatles came. And that changed everything, because then I wanted to be a musician. And I formed a band at school in my early teens with a great mate of mine, still one of my best mates of all time, Chaz Kronk. And when we left school, which was after we did our A-levels, we continued to be, you know, wanted to be musicians. So we did every job, well, I did certainly, any job that was going, in order to keep gigging or buying equipment. I worked in a laundry for a bit. I worked at Radio Rentals, sending out, I didn't like it, but sending out nasty letters to poor little old ladies. "You haven't paid your 4 shillings for this month's, you know, rental," or whatever it happens to be. I worked in Rank Bush Murphy, where they sold TVs and radios. Lots of things. Oh, a hair dye factory, where I sat on the assembly line as the bottles came past. You have to, you know, push them up into a little dispenser, which fills it up with hair dye, and all these things. Until about probably the age of 22 or something like that, when I was making enough to just be a musician, and I've been one ever since. So that was... And then I did all sorts of things. You kick off playing what you like to play, and then reality comes in and you begin to do things like, well, actually, it's funny because I never told many people this. I used to play in a clip joint. That's like a kind of a strip club in the West End from 9 o'clock till 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And it was owned by a guy who was a compatriot of the Cray twins, because the Crays had lots of things. So we were playing this kind of, we were playing music 6 hours a night, 6.5 hours a night with little breaks. And it was a great training ground because you had to learn lots of different kinds of things to please clients or to please the people who walked in. So it was anything from Je T'aime, which was a huge hit, you know, kind of an organ piece, to reggae, to general popular music, whatever it happened to be. And it gave me a very broad training in music. So that happened. At 28, I went to college to do a degree. By that time, I was so interested in learning more because I didn't learn a great deal. I knew a bit, but just playing pop music doesn't really train you. And I decided, and I went to college as a what they call a mature student and was accepted. And then I really began to learn about music, and it was the most fantastic 3 years down in Devon at a place called Dartington Hall, where they had a wonderful music college. Took up other instruments, the baroque flute, the cello. And the reason I picked Dartington was it had the only, at the time, this is in the late 70s, it had the only course which included Indian music. And I bought a sitar, and for 2 years I did sitar playing. Although I've still got one, but I don't do it anymore because it takes as much dedication as any. If you want to play it proper, you do your 8 hours a day. And I didn't have the time for that. By that time I had family and my first daughter was born and so on. But it was a very interesting and eclectic education, and I learned lots about music that way. And then, to cut to the chase, really, the next sort of 30-odd years were a mixture of gigging, playing in different bands. I did, for a couple of years, I was in Phil Manzanera's band. Now, Phil Manzanera was the guitar player of Roxy Music, and when Roxy Music split up, different members did different things. So I did a couple of albums with him, toured Europe a couple of times with him. I had one of the best experiences was in 73. I went to America with a band called Blue Aquarius, and we were there for about 10 months. And I'm happy to say, the only thing I'm really, well, I'm saying this, I sound like I'm being showing off, but I'm very proud to say I was a Stax recording artist. Stax was the hippest black soul label. There was only Stax and Motown. They were the two labels. All right, there was Chess, for the people who are listening, who did blues and, but you know, Stax was it. It had Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, Booker T and the MGs. And we did one album for Stax, and so it was just terrific. I mean, long gone now, but it was a thrill. It was wonderful. And then after that, you know, various things. As you get older, you know you're not going to crack it in the big scene sort of thing, because you have to be young and pretty for that. And my youth and prettiness had long gone. But I was a good general session musician and did things for different people, wrote a lot. And I found myself in 1993 looking back on an interesting musical life and deciding I'm going to sing calypso. And the reason for that was I was always attracted to protest songs. I'm a great believer in speaking out against injustice. Bob Dylan did it. John Lennon did it. These are all heroes of mine. Bob Marley did it, of course. Get up, stand up, those kinds of things. So, and Kaiso, as the real word for calypso, Kaiso was steeped in that, and I thought, I'll go back to that. And interestingly, it was the best thing I ever did, because the last 20-odd years have been very good for me, in that I write what I want to write, and I get booked to sing it, and I don't have to carry, I should have mentioned before, I was a keyboard player. I should have said that. I was a keyboard player, and I haven't done a gig on keyboards now for more than 5 years, and I used to have to carry two keyboards around, amps, mixers, you name it.
Yeah.
And I'm getting long in the tooth now, and lifting those things got too heavy. So now I've switched to a Spanish guitar, and all I need to do is turn up with my guitar, and I sing songs, my own stuff, and I get paid to do it. So I'm a happy man.
Wow, I can imagine. So let's go to your first tune then.
Okay, well,
When We Was Fab.
When We Was Fab by George Harrison. Now, the reason I picked that, I was a huge Beatles fan, and I will say unequivocally, the Beatles had the biggest influence on pop music since they were around. I mean, everything, the early 60s, the British pop scene, which actually took America by storm, and it would never have done so without the Beatles. The Beatles made the difference, without any shadow of doubt. There were four bands. People might argue, but there were four bands. It was the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, and the Kinks. Those four bands led the way. The Beatles had the advantage of having the best producer, so they always sounded really fat on record. They're, you know, the bass sounds was big, everything was sounding big. The Stones' early stuff was actually a bit more scratchy. They were loud, but they didn't sound as as groove. The Beatles just grooved. The Stones didn't so much, and they didn't have the advantage of the great harmonies the Beatles had. The Beatles' only rivals were really the Beach Boys, who were equally good. They were a great band, but there wasn't anybody else. So the reason I've picked this is the Beatles had sort of 9 great years, and then it petered out, and the split came. And in the early years, George Harrison was kind of sat on. When I say sat on, he was the youngest in the band. And the others, they didn't have one track per album until he got, until you get further into their career. And then he starts to get a couple more. And then he made the brilliant Within You, Without You on the Sgt. Pepper album. And after that, when the White Album came out, he had 4 great songs on it. And then after the split up, I personally think he flourished more than any of the others, because he came out with the All Things Must Pass album, and then he just went on from strength to strength. Whereas, and you can disagree, or people can, McCartney has not, in my humble opinion, done anything as good as the Beatles when he was in the Beatles since then. I know he did Wings and everything, but Wings never held a candle to the great songs he did during the Beatles. So this song by Harrison encapsulates everything about the Beatles. It's called When We Was Fab, and there's bits and pieces of I'm the Walrus. There's so many allusions to their sound. You can hear bits of I'm the Walrus in there. You can hear bits of the early hits. It's all in there. And it's just a great tune, and it reminisces about that great band.
Brilliant. Let's listen to that song then.
Back then, long time ago, when grass was green, woke up in a daze, arrived like strangers in the night. Fab. Long time ago, when we was fab. Morning light, casualties at dawn, and we did it all. Long time ago, when we was fab, that magnified the tears, studied warts and arm, still alive for all and all. Long time ago, when we was fab, fab. But it's all over now, baby. Blue.
the next song, Marvin Gaye.
Okay.
Tell me about this.
What's going on was the most incredible eye-opener for anybody who liked soul music. I mean, I was a big Motown fan anyway, and I liked the soul and everything. What's going on is actually in the sense of, well, it's a song cycle. It's a concept album.
Yeah.
In the way that, even going back to classical days, Schubert did song cycle albums. He did albums. He didn't do albums. He wrote songs that were linked by a theme, so you get a song cycle. And this was Marvin Gaye's. And it's actually the perspective of a Vietnam War veteran coming back and seeing everything that's wrong with the world. I mean, what's going on is all about the problems that already beset us and were going to continue to beset us. It's interesting that Berry Gordy, who of course started Motown, hated the album. When Marvin Gaye played it to him, he said he wasn't going to release it. And Marvin Gaye said, if you don't release it, I'm off your label. Forget it. I'm leaving. That's it. He was one of their biggest selling artists. I mean, Heard It Through the Grapevine is one of the defining tracks of Motown. Yeah. So he threatened to leave, and they had to release it. And of course, Berry Gordy was proved wrong, because Rolling Stone magazine made What's Going On the sixth of their 500 best albums ever. Wow. So in their list of 500 best albums, Rolling Stone magazine, with all the cred that's got, it's number six. I don't know what the ones above it are, but I do know that. And it's just an incredible experience. It's just so different from anything else that happened before. And it came out in 1971 when Angela Davis, there was the Chicago 7, there was all that sort of, the Black Power stuff was going on, all the emancipation, the real kind of emancipation,
yeah,
that really did start to strike home. The riots, the student riots, all that was going on. And what's going on came out in the middle of that and really made its point. It's a fantastic track and it's a fantastic album.
Ooh.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on.
right on. Right on.
So that song there by Marvin Gaye, that came out kind of in the heat of the moment. So what were you doing?
I was in an original band at the time. I can't remember. We were doing various bits and pieces, I think, trying to record. Chaz, my great mate, had gone off to join the Straubs, which he's still in nowadays. And he's actually been, financially speaking, he's been much more successful than I, because I have to say this. Bless you, Chaz, if you ever hear this. The Straubs' music doesn't grab me particularly. It's kind of folk, pop, rock, punk, whatever, of a certain type. But he is one of the best songwriters I know, and he's a great friend, and he's a great guitarist. However, why not go where the success is? He's on tour now. He's still touring. They still tour all the time. And he did very well. I was trying other things out at the time. I think, in fact, I was in a duo at the time, an original duo. Now, there's a funny story there. Melody, I think it was probably earlier than 71, but Melody Maker, the magazine, did a thing called the Melody Maker Search, where it was the first ever of these search for a band things. It wasn't like Opportunity Knocks, it was just rock bands. And we'd had a band, oh yeah, that's right, we'd had a band with a guy called Jim Avery in it. Now, Jim was extremely good looking and a great bass player. And it must have been 69, thinking about it now, because Something in the Air Tonight came out by Thunderclap Newman, and he was asked to join Thunderclap Newman, and of course, off he went. Chaz had gone off at that point, I think, not the Straubs yet, but he'd gone off to do other things, and that left just the drummer and me. And we called up the agency for whom we'd been doing stuff, and we, you know, did, in those days it was college gigs, which were great. There was a lot of work about them for live bands. And the guy's name was Pete Tobin, I think, and we said, Pete, got any gigs for us? He said, what's it? Got a new band now. And he said, when can I hear the band? I have to hear it before I can book it. And I said, oh, I don't know. What have you got? He said, I'll tell you what. Melody Maker Search is on, and there's 70 bands in it, and the last heat is at Goldsmiths College next Thursday. I was talking to him on a Saturday. He said, Goldsmiths College next Thursday. And Boris, which is another band, they've pulled out, so there's a slot there, half-hour slot. If you bring your band down there, you won't win or anything, but I can see what they're like and say, book it. So I sat down with Keith, who's my friend that sadly died now, but sat down with Keith, and we wrote 10 songs between the Sunday and the Thursday and tried to learn them with just organ and drums. So it was an organ-drums duo, played a Hammond. And we went down there, and strange enough, we won the heat because it was all original stuff. It was quite good. And then in the Melody Maker Search, we came third out of the 70 bands. So the upshot was we didn't win the contest, but we started gigging. So that was really quite a good piece. So that's what I was doing. We were doing, because we were only a duo, we were no threat to big bands. Big bands like to not, they don't want to be blown off the stage by some lower band. And so I remember doing an all-nighter where there were 10 bands on. Rare Bird was on. They had a number one with Sympathy Is What We Need, My Friend. That was a big hit at the time. Traffic, The Move. And anyway, they brought over a band called Love from California, Arthur Lee's Love, who had a huge hit with a song called Alone Again Or, and they were top of the bill. And they put us on just before Love because they didn't want Traffic or Move or somebody to kind of threaten their supremacy. And so we always got beautiful billings because on these gigs, everybody would come into the hall ready for the big band and they'd get half an hour of us. So they'd see us. So we had huge audiences. And that lasted for a bit of time and then it kind of petered out as things do. So that's what I was doing when What's Going On was coming out. But then, as I say, I then went to the States with this band, Blue Aquarius, and we toured a bit, as I say, we did some festivals and some good gigs, and that was lovely. We were there for about 10 months. There was money behind the band, but the money kind of ran out, as these things do, and I came back, you know. But yeah, that was that period.
So, song number three.
Now, Kitchener. Song number three, yeah, Kitchener. Now, in my humble opinion, Kitchener is the greatest Calypsonian ever was and possibly ever will be. There are people who might disagree. I'm not talking about soca singers. I'm just talking about Calypsonians. And there will be people who argue, no, 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 it's Mighty Sparrow. Well, let's put it this way. Sparrow and Kitchener are the two greats. If we're talking classical, we're talking Bach and Handel. Or if we're talking Baroque, we're talking Bach and Handel. If we're talking classical, we're talking Mozart and Beethoven. If we're talking jazz, we might be, or big band jazz, we might be talking about Duke Ellington, Count Basie. I don't know. Put it whichever way. But they're the two greats. But Kitchener has a particular knack of just writing brilliant melodies. And he also is responsible, I think, almost single-handedly, for developing the steel band tune. I mean, in the early days, early steel pan used to be playing well-known songs. I mean, way back in the 40s, that's what you did. There wasn't anything specifically written for pan. They did well-known tunes, usually the calypso of the day, which were simple, you know, verse-chorus things. They weren't elaborate. They had short, you know, Matilda, 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 she take me money and go on Venezuela. That kind of tune would have been, it was a hit for 3 years running. It was Road March for 3 years running from 38 to 1940. So they would play things like that. Kitchener started out there and he began to stretch it and stretch it. And I had the great fortune of seeing Kitchener, visiting him four times in Trinidad. He said, and there's a story behind that too, funny story. I'm jumping forward in time, but there's a reason for this. In 1994, Brian Lara broke two world records in cricket. The 375 at the Test match and then the 501, which he scored playing for Warwickshire in a first-class match. So, and he did it in, I think, May of 94. So it was too late for Carnival in Trinidad. Mm-hmm. With my sister Sarah, wrote a song, Lash Dem Lara, about a week after he did his great achievement. And Brian Lara came over in June of that year, because to be feted, to be celebrated. And by then we recorded it, and I gave him a cassette of the song. So the first song he heard about himself, or had, I feel sure I'd given him. Well, the following year, obviously February 1995, was Carnival, and there are about 35 songs about him, and I think, I can't remember which won the Road March, won the Monarch. It was, I think, For Lara, Four by Superblue, or somebody. If I got that wrong, apologies, folks. Anyway, somebody won. But Lash Dem Lara had a bit of an impact, and, oh gosh, I've forgotten the question. What was it? What was I talking about? Oh, yeah. Why Lash Dem Lara? Oh, yes, sorry. I got it. No, I've got it now. You can cut that bit out. I was in Hilo, which was the local... In Trinidad, it's the equivalent of Sainsbury's or Tesco and stuff. Okay. Other supermarkets are available, folks. I went to Hilo because I stay with cousins. There's plenty of cousins there. And there was no food in the house. I was staying with a lovely cousin, my cousin Michelle, who was not that well off, and she had about five of us, all the cousins would come from America, England, wherever, and just sleep on the floor because it's Carnival time. And I said, let me go down the road and get some food. So I went down with my younger cousin, her son, and when we're in Hilo, I hear coming over the loudspeaker, is that Alexander the Great in the shop, please, because he would like him, please would he hurry home because Lord Kitchener wants to have a word with him. I thought, this is a wind up. What's with these cousins of mine? Oh, gosh, man, oh, you could play tricks, eh, what? So I get back there, and it was true. Another cousin who lived in Dego Martin, where Reina Rama was, which is Kitchener's house, named after one of his big hits. She used to go past and keep the time of day with him all the time. I mean, she was friendly with everybody and so on. And she happened to mention, my cousin's visiting, and... from England, and he's got a song called Lash Dem Lara. Now, what I have forgotten to tell you is that prior to that, about a week before, my uncle, who worked for Trinidad Guardian, he was a cricket correspondent, I'd gone to see him and tell him I was around, and, you know, and he said, "Ah, while you're here, let me do a little something on you." So he did a little article about me, and in it he asked me, one of the things he asked was, "Who's your favourite Kelly singer?" I said, "Old Kitchener, without a doubt." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Because nobody does melodies the way he does, and also he has these fantastic structures. He has more than two sections. He doesn't just have verse and chorus. He has verse, bridge and chorus, and sometimes he even has four sections. He has what I call a false chorus. You think it's a chorus, but then something else happens and it's the real chorus. And the real chorus for me is when the audience join in, because call and response is the basis of calypso or that kind of thing. So that to be a bit where the audience can shout out something. And mine was, "Lash them, lash them, lash them, Lara," and then I would answer it. So I'm describing this about Kitchener and saying how wonderful he is, and he had read the article. And when my cousin Greer told him her cousin, she said, "But I know that. I read in the Guardian about this fella, this Alexander." So anyway, it was true. And he said, "Come round." So I went round to see him and had a lovely hours meeting with him, chatting about things. Because of course, he was in England in the 50s, and it was just a love feast of discussions. I was totally overawed by the man's presence, but he was so sweet-natured and good and nice to me. And he said, "Anytime you're in Trinidad, call me up and come and visit." So I did that. And I did ask him, because I know what you were talking about, steel pan. I asked him how he developed this. He said, "Well, he wanted to write. He always had a hankering really to write classical kinds of things. And in classical music, you have what they call the exposition of the tune, and then you play around with the tune, you muck around with it, and you alter it and you vary it, and all these. And that's how, you know, certainly in the classic era." That's how steel pan tunes were. They were tunes that the arranger could get his teeth into or her teeth into and really muck around with the arrangements. So it had, and that's Kitchener. Kitchener just, you know, he was the master. He created the long pan tune almost single-handedly. Other people had to follow him. Otherwise, it would have just been old verse and choruses. Anyway, yeah. So there you go.
Inspiration.
He was.
So which song, which Kitchener?
Well, I'm going to pick Mystery Band. Mystery Band is a glorious song. It's got a most fantastic tune. It's got Kitchener answering the coming down, whoa, water coming down, eh, river coming down, bang, putugang, bang, bang, putugang, 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 putugang. He's emulating the pan. He's being onomatopoeic. Yeah. He's just kind of what you call black speak. That's where you just make sounds.
Yeah.
David Rudder does it too, and others do it. And it's just the most brilliant tune. And there's also the metaphor. Because you have to listen to it, find out who the mystery band is. And I'm not going to say what it is because it's obvious in the third verse. You find out, they think this is mystery band playing. Every time it rains, they hear a band, but no one sees anybody. So it's a great story behind it. And it's the peak of metaphor and the way Calypso should be. It's just beautiful.
Brilliant. Well, let's find out who the mystery band are. This is the Kitchener track.
Darling, we all hearing, but can't see this orchestra. Pan beating whole night in the dry river. Darling, we all hearing, but can't see this orchestra. Well, another thing confusing the whole public. You could only hear the band when rain fall. We had to believe it's mystery or sheer magic. Why it is we can't see this band at all?
And so it starts. What is a drop in the heart of Port of Spain?
Ding, 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 ding,
massive crowd gather from all over the country. They flocked the dry river just for curiosity. It was ridiculous the way how they all argued. They were vociferous with all different point of view. Some say the music sung like the late 40s. Some say it sung like a band from space. But however it sung, every man was pleased, for it surely had me shaking the waist.
And so it started to rain. But it's a drop in the heart of Porter's Spain. People bring a big umbrella, ladies like a brave weather, to see this mystery band in the river. They're flat, bringing down a set of debris.
Found out after the truth of the mystery band, it caused a great laughter with every man and woman. They started all giggling, the joke caught them so abrupt. They couldn't stop laughing to see how they get full up. Get joke, milking coming down in the flood water with all kind of old bottle and old can. A ting-a-ling-a-ling, they're bouncing up each other, and they're mistaking it for a steel band.
And so it started to rain. What is that drop in the heart of Porter's Spain? People bring a big umbrella, they decide to break the weather, to see this mystery band in the river. They fly, bringing down a set of debris.
Quite a contrast to your tracks that we've listened to already. Tell me the story behind this.
Okay.
Why this particular concerto?
Well, when I was at college, I fell in love with Baroque music big time. Now, Baroque music is from the period about 1650 to 1750. And why Baroque music is so much... What's special about Baroque music is that, like popular music, it wasn't all written down exactly note for note. When it came to the classical period, which started really with Haydn, Mozart, 1750s with Haydn, and there was a transition from Baroque into early classical, and then you get the peak of it with Beethoven and all that, everything was written down. What you wanted played, you wrote it, and the performers performed it. But in the Baroque era, just like in jazz, they had something called, I can describe it. Jazz and pop musicians use chord symbols. Well, they just write E7 or A minor or things like that as A, capital A, and a small m. In the same way, Baroque music, you used to have and the most important line in Baroque music was the bass line. The bass line couldn't be changed. So whatever the cello or the bassoon, whoever's playing it, that couldn't be changed. But above the bass note, you would write numbers. Like you might write 6-4, which meant that you played the bass note and a note, six notes above it and four notes above that again. So it produced a particular kind of inversion. And it was an early form, really, of chord symbols. And then you might write a very slim, when I say slim, you might write a tune above it with just a few notes. And players were expected to improvise on those notes. And the better the player, sometimes they went completely over the top. So if you think of your rock guitarist,
yeah,
or you think of your jazz saxophonist blowing over the chords,
yeah,
that's what it was in the Baroque era. And there are now wonderful recordings where people go really over the top, and what you think is a simple melody is actually being improvised upon. So, and they travel around from place to place. It was also the fact that, obviously before recordings or anything, sheet music was the way publishers made their money.
Yeah.
And so, and Handel was particularly good at writing simple melodies that were available to the... You imagine, in a world where the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker had worked all week, and on a Sunday they got together and yeah, they would say, guess what, I've got the latest Telemann, you know, quartets or trios or something, or the latest Handel solo sonatas. They weren't really solo, they meant it was for a treble instrument and then a bass instrument and also the continuo. The continuo meant the person that played the chord. So it could be on a harpsichord, it could be on a lute, it could be on anything that was available. And so they get together and they get excited. Now, if you weren't very good, you just played the melody. If you were reasonably good, you improvised a bit. And if you were a real professional, you showed off like crazy. So the Baroque era is my favorite era in classical music. Of those, and I believe him to be the greatest composer that ever lived, Johann Sebastian Bach is the boss. He's our boss. Ain't nobody like him. And the Brandenburg Concertos are fabulous. Six concertos, which unfortunately Bach never heard played, because the story behind it, he wrote them, they're called the Brandenburgs, because he was going for a job with the Margrave of Brandenburg. So he sent them these compositions to get the gig, and they were put away in a cupboard and not discovered till about 100 years after his death, because the Marquis, or the Margrave, whoever it was, either wasn't interested or didn't have the time. So they were shoved away, and they are the most exquisite and brilliant works. And the fourth Brandenburg is for two recorders and violin, and obviously orchestra. When I say orchestra, we're talking a small orchestra here, not a symphony mm-hmm. orchestra. We're talking about six people. There'd be a harpsichord, a bass player, or a cellist, and maybe a couple of first violins, a couple of second violins, a viola, and then the main players.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have maybe an image or a vision or an oral perspective of a recorder being something nasty, which is out of tune, that you play at school. When you hear this, you hear how recorders should sound. It's absolutely glorious. And the violin solo in the middle is tremendous. So this is the fourth Brandenburg Concerto by Johann Sebastian Bach.
So I think that's maybe the first and maybe even the last time we may hear some Bach on Carnival Radio.
Maybe.
But, you know, things do change.
Yeah.
Your next song, Steely Dan.
Steely Dan, after the Beatles, are certainly, the. All right, up until about 1980, maybe 81, they were the band with the most original and stretching chord progressions, songs, just the playing was unbelievable. They were a very expensive band, apparently. Well, they made an album called Gaucho, which was their last great album together, because they've done a couple since then, which I don't think are as good. When they made Gaucho, there were only 7 tracks on it, and we're talking about 1980, so we're talking 35 years ago. And when they'd spent $1 million on the album, ABC Records said, we're not spending anymore. So they got a bailout from that to do a deal with somebody else to get another $200,000 to finish the album. Now, the reason it was so expensive, they hired the best musicians available on a regular basis. They were like $2,000 a day. And they may not, you know, you might do 30 takes of something. What they were looking for was the perfect take. Nowadays it's easy, you do things on computer, you can drop stuff in, you can alter it, you can change it, and the computer does everything. I find that all a bit stiff and a bit clinical. What they were going for was an ultimate performance, and they got them. It was a moment when all the musicians in the studio at the same time gelled, and it happened. It always gelled. But they were looking for just some kind of magic, and they always got it. Also, I love reggae, but I've only got 6 tracks. So this song, Haitian Divorce, combines, I mean, it's not real reggae, but it's their take on reggae. So there's a reggae beat to it. Also, Skunk Baxter, who's the guitar player, plays something called a voice box, which makes the guitar growl and wail, and kind of does, it's not like a wah-wah, it's more than that. It's just, it's fantastic. It snarls at you. And the playing is just brilliant, and the song's brilliant. And this is Haitian Divorce by Steely Dan.
Papa said, Mom, no hesitation.
Final song, definitely one of my favourites, and I'm no doubt one of the most famous songs, perhaps, by Stevie Wonder, yeah. Covered thousands, hundreds of thousands of times, right. I'm sure, as, why this song, out of all the songs?
There were so many. First of all, let me say, in popular music, I think he's the greatest songwriter of the 20th century. I know there's lots to choose from, and people might